Greetings, y bienvenidos to part one of the best of the Latino Media Collective in 2025 here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Occupied Washington. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we take a look back on the year that was in 2025 for both the Latino community here in the U.S. and the biggest moments in Latin America and the Caribbean. This episode is focused on the Trump administration's assault on immigrant people of color via ICE, one of, if not the most important story of 2025. But the assault, marginalization, and scapegoating of immigrants is neither new nor original in the U.S. So, for example, we started 2025 by discussing the repatriation of Mexicans during the Great Depression and the parallels we can draw during that time period. So here's our conversation from March with freelance writer Nikki Duda and labor historian Emiliano Aguilar discussing Mexican repatriation in the state of Indiana. So we're going to go back and forth from the past to the present to explain why repatriation from the 1930s remains relevant today. So let me begin with Professor Aguilar by asking two questions. One, could you explain the Mexican repatriation of the 1930s as a means not to confuse it with the aforementioned Bracero program, which is a totally different issue, but equally important as well? And two, how does the state of Indiana serve as the best backdrop to explain the institutional racism behind the repatriations? Again, this was nationwide, but Indiana in particular serves as a special backdrop, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So repatriation movement, thinking quite literally, repatriation or the act of repatriating to send someone back to their own country is really a contested word for this decade of betrayal, as two historians, Francisco Valderrama, Raymond Rodriguez, call this period that coincides with the Great Depression. So we think of repatriation movement as this quote unquote voluntary return of Mexicans from 1929 to 1939. And while the numbers are really contested, right, anywhere ranging from 300,000 to 2 million, depending on the source, the key takeaway from this is that something that's described as a voluntary movement of folks from their new homes or from their areas, their environments, their residencies in the United States back to Mexico is quite conflated. Many of these were themselves actually American citizens. And thinking about Indiana in particular, it lets us see how one particular generation, sort of this first generation born of immigrant parents, are sent home, are threatened to be sent home, or threatened to be sent to Mexico, I should say. Their home is the United States during a period where non-Mexicans, non-Latinos are viewing the Mexican as an economic threat. They're taking their jobs. This is a moment of economic precarity that many folks are trying to solve, right? How do we fix the Great Depression? And in the Indiana context, we see a group, the American Legion, and their commander, Paul Kelly, really take it upon themselves to do so. They solicit funds from places like Inland Steel, the very company that recruited Mexicans as strikebreakers in 1919 during the Great Steel Strike, to now provide money to send Mexicans to Mexico and Mexican Americans to Mexico. So Indiana becomes quite a neat way to complicate this idea of this being voluntary, while also complicating the idea that, you know, this is done federal government down, and really highlighting the grassroots efforts of quite literally like very xenophobic actions within a community.
We can easily have this conversation with regards to border states like Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, but in the case of the state of Indiana, we may be focusing mostly on the north side of Indiana, East Chicago, places like Gary, that part of the region there in the state of Indiana. But as we said before, this was nationwide. And you mentioned a very important issue right there, which is strike breaking, which we will hit upon further during the course of this conversation. But Nikki, as I mentioned, you recently wrote an article for In These Times about your family connection to the repatriation of the 1930s. I wonder if you could give us a few details of your family history that you believe run parallel to recent anti-immigrant sentiment here in the U.S. It's a sweeping question, I know, but again, we are living in a time not only of anti-immigrant sentiment, but also sort of a moment of anti-history as well, that there's not enough emphasis that what's happening, as I said before, is neither new nor original.
Sure. So a few summers ago, my grandmother passed away. She was born and raised, lived her entire life in East Chicago. And my mom was also born there and grew up there. And so after she passed, my mom and I went to the East Chicago Public Library because they have a room there that Emiliano knows, I'm sure, with a great local historian, Susana Bursic, and a lot of cool primary documents and old microfilms and stuff like that. And we were thinking we would go see if we could find a picture of my grandma's old apartment building in the harbor, which is the neighborhood that we're talking about in East Chicago. And we couldn't find that, but Susana handed us a book called Harbor Lights, Mexican-American Harbor Lights. And she said, look up your family's last name in the back. Maybe there's something there, because my mom's grandfather worked in the mills. Her dad worked in the mills. Yeah, so she looked up their last name. She looked up Lopez, and there was a story written by one of my grandma's sisters, an essay, talking about this moment where the family almost left. So my grandma would have been about 2 years old. And I had never heard this story. And it was shocking to me because I knew about this. I knew about the repatriation movement, and we had never been told about it. So it kind of, one of my older aunts knew, I think, which I mentioned in the article, but it kind of highlighted this shame that was associated with that time of like being the other, having your neighbors turn against you, having people pressuring you to leave, having people not want to live in the neighborhood where they work, which we'll talk about later with the Walker Report, because you're there, because you're making the neighborhood bad, you're making it dirty, you're bringing syphilis into the community, you're bringing crime and all these other things, which obviously are not true and have some nativist and xenophobic elements. Of course, our family on that side has always been very proud of their heritage and at the same time has this desire to appear very American, this desire to, yeah, not to be identified with anything immigrant, which maybe someone who hears that will get upset that I said that, but that's neither here nor there. And so it kind of illuminated the why there. And it kind of also illuminated what people are going through right now and how that's going to affect future generations growing up, how it's going to affect their relationship with their identity, how it will shape their relationship to the community, wanting to learn Spanish or not, or your name is Marcelino and you go by Mark or something like that. So yeah, and also it was in East Chicago, it was maybe up to, correct me if I'm wrong, Emiliano, but maybe like 2,500 families who were affected, or not families, people, and many more in Chicago. And when I shared this article on social media, I had someone who I've known since first grade, who's also Mexican-American, wrote me and said, hey, that happened to my family and they did go back. And then my grandparents had to immigrate again later, that he has a great aunt who is a U.S. citizen who went back and lived the rest of her life in Mexico. Like, it totally shifted the course of his family's history and broke their ties with the United States, even though they had this daughter who was born an American. And in the harbor, there were, you know, baseball teams. I know my grandpa played on a baseball team in the harbor, and they were like engaged in all these very traditionally American activities, and that, yeah, that their neighbors didn't see it that way and saw them as an other, which in a lot of ways had to do with this strike as well as good old fashioned racism.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up this issue of the desire to be American or be more American, as you said, because I sort of had that feeling that that was something underlying the institutional racism that is not only mentioned in your article for In These Times, but also in a few articles that Professor Aguilar wrote in Belt Magazine, that this was mentioned in passing, which is not only discovering this family information, but the difficulties of finding this information as well. So I guess my question is here is that did this institutional racism that both of you have spoken about, and Professor Aguilar, you can answer this as well, also extended to even record keeping with regards to people not trying to associate themselves with being Mexican or hiding their last names or hiding the fact that they speak another language? Because I felt like doing my research with regards to this issue before today's interview, this was something that was also underlying the fact that this is not as covered as often as it should. And to what I said earlier, which is this moment of anti-history that we're living in, Professor Aguilar.
Absolutely. Institutional racism and this intersection or this impact on record keeping, I mean, becomes a very key bit on why early Latino history in particular becomes so difficult to document, right? The fact that with the exception of this particular moment of repatriation, Latinos aren't even a census category well until 70s and 80s, right? Where we start to see the rise of the Hispanic. And so much of it becomes even like what we know of 1930 is tied inherently to wanting to exclude the Mexican. And in this exclusion, we sort of see a want, a desire to hide identities wherever possible, right? In East Chicago, one of the really great examples of this is Greg Estelle, who was a lawyer, but by that name alone, you would never have guessed he's a Latino, right? That he purposely changes his name. He's white passing. He gets to live in the north side of East Chicago away from the early colony that, like Nikki mentioned, one of the densest concentrations of Mexicans in the United States. Thousands of folks within this one square mile, estimated of about 5,000. And Estelle and his family get to live outside of that because of his white passing, because of this change of the name. And it affords him, as well as his like middle class professional background as a lawyer, a degree of protection during this moment. He and his family have this degree of protection because of that. And then in terms of like just keeping the records, the repatriation movement in Chicago crafts sort of these lists that we'll talk about here in a bit, these lists that let the American Legion in particular keep track of who's Mexican, how many Mexicans are living, where are they in a particular residence, what they do for work, are they on welfare or not, how many children do they have, what are those children's names. It becomes a really, I described it to Nikki, haunting document, a primary source to have been left behind, this record that both gives us an opportunity to see how vibrant this community was, but also the precarity of their situation. That knowing that we only know this information because this dedicated cohort of American Legion members wanted to subsequently repatriate or really just deport these families of mixed status too.
So going back to Nikki, considering what Professor Aguilar just mentioned, can you tell us, once you discovered this information about your family history, how difficult was it afterwards to try to make these connections afterwards of this moment in history?
Yeah. So one of my great aunts, had my grandma's youngest sister, had written an essay that was part of this collection created by women from the neighborhood. And in it, she mentions that they were going to be sent, quote unquote, back to Mexico because my great grandparents were immigrated and all of their kids were born in the United States, in Kansas and in Indiana. And so from her essay, it was pretty clear what was going on. And we were able to talk to Susanna about it over at the library. And it kind of highlights a lot of what, like you guys are saying, what mixed status families are worried about going through today, because you have the Holman or whatever his name is, the border czar, saying, oh, if it comes to it, instead of separating families, we'll just deport them all together. And we kind of like to act like that's this absurd thing and that couldn't be done and you can't deport U.S. citizens, but that's happened in the past. Even if it's been in a way of like the community pushing people out, or if it's been in an official capacity, that's something that's happened.
In early April, we had the pleasure of speaking with Salvadoran Professor Jorge Cuellar, just as the case of Salvadoran migrant Kilman Albrego Garcia gained national headlines. This case also raised international awareness to the notorious Secaut prison in El Salvador that continues to make headlines for torturing and illegally detaining migrants from other countries. Here's Jorge's breakdown of the controversy. You know, oftentimes right-wing governments in Latin America will follow whatever model, whatever Trump-like model there is in the United States. But I think I could argue, or we could argue, that it's actually the Trump administration trying to copy the Bukele model as far as governance is concerned, because as we have this conversation right now, Trump is floating the idea of running for a third term, which is insane, not to mention unconstitutional. So now that we have that in context, let's go straight to the issue by addressing the illegality of Bukele's administration's arrangement with the Trump administration to send migrants to El Salvador. Perhaps the best example of the scheme is the recent story last week of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran migrant living in Maryland who was wrongfully deported despite having protected status. Since then, the Department of Justice has admitted that his deportation was an administrative error. Here is White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt responding to a reporter when asked about this case. Let's take a listen.
Jeff, a few minutes ago, you said you'd seen evidence that this man was a convicted gang member. In what court was he convicted and for what?
This individual was an MS-13 ringleader. This individual was also engaged in human trafficking. And I'm glad you brought up this point again, because I would like to point out that if you just saw the headline from the insane failing Atlantic magazine this morning, you would think this individual was father of the year, living in Maryland, living a peaceful life, when that couldn't be further from the truth. They didn't even mention in the title of that article or even in the first paragraph that this individual is an illegal criminal who broke our nation's immigration laws. He is a leader in the brutal MS-13 gang, and he is involved in human trafficking. And now MS-13 is a designated foreign terrorist organization. Foreign terrorists have no legal protections in the United States of America. And this administration is going to continue to deport foreign terrorists and illegal criminals from our nation's interior.
But a judge ordered that he should remain in this country. So are you saying that it is okay to ignore a judge's ruling if you don't like it?
Who does that judge work for?
An
immigration judge who works for the Department of Justice at the direction of the Attorney General of the United States, whose name is Pam Bondi, who has committed to eradicating MS-13 from our nation's interior. And let me tell you why we've made this commitment. MS-13, may I remind each and every one of you, is a brutal and vicious gang. They raped and strangled a 20-year-old autistic woman to death in Maryland. They hacked 4 people to death with machetes in a park on Long Island. They have kidnapped, sexually tortured, and shot a teenage girl in Texas after she insulted them, allegedly. Killed and mutilated a 17-year-old girl in Virginia, stabbing him 16 times and cutting off his hands. They beheaded and cut out the heart of a man in Washington, D.C. They raped and murdered a 13-year-old girl in California. They sex trafficked a slew of young girls, including one who was just 12 years old. Raped an 11-year-old girl in Brooklyn while her brother was in the room. Sex trafficked a 13-year-old in Maryland and Virginia, miles away from this White House, even beating her 26 times on her backside with a baseball bat. Pressured homeless New Yorkers to undergo unnecessary surgeries such as spinal fusion in order to bolster their fraudulent lawsuits. These are vicious criminals. This is a vicious gang. And I wish that the media would spend just a second of the same time you have spent trying to litigate each and every individual of this gang who has been deported from our country as the innocent Americans whose lives have been lost at the hands of these brutal criminals. We maintain our position, and very strongly so.
That was disgusting. And it's certainly a look into the mind of madness with this current administration. So with that said, now here's a CBS News report, which includes an interview with Abrego Garcia's wife last week. Let's take a listen.
I waited and waited. He never made that call.
Jennifer says when her husband, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, was detained and mistakenly deported by immigration authorities in March, he told her he could be sent to Secot, the notorious Salvadorian prison.
I was scared. I was very scared.
Why?
Because I've seen news of that prison, and I know they take criminals there, and my husband's not a criminal.
Abrego Garcia was granted legal status protecting him from deportation back to El Salvador in 2019 because of safety concerns in his home country. Jennifer says he continued to check in with immigration officials until he was stopped by ICE on March 12 in Maryland. Just days later, Jennifer saw this photo of Abrego Garcia inside Sakot.
When I saw it, I immediately broke down because I knew it was him.
What was your biggest fear when you identified him?
I was scared for his life.
In court documents filed Monday, the government said although ICE was aware of his protection from removal, Abrego Garcia was removed to El Salvador because of an administrative error. Now that he's out of the country, officials say they have no jurisdiction to bring him back.
The error that you are referring to was a clerical error. It was an administrative error.
The Trump administration acknowledged the mistake, but defended Abrego Garcia's deportation.
He is a leader in the brutal MS-13 gang, and he is involved in human trafficking.
The White House did not detail any evidence that proves those allegations. Jennifer says her husband is not a gang member, but instead just a proud father of their five-year-old son with disabilities.
He's not a criminal. My husband is an amazing person, an amazing father.
So that was the wife of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. So again, Jorge, as that case as an example, give us your thoughts here with regards to Bukele's arrangement here with the Trump administration. The case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, you know, may not be the first case, but it certainly won't be the last one so long as this scheme continues.
Yeah, man. I mean, there's so much going on in those clips, you know, with Caroline Levitt, man, the way that she, you know, sort of plays upon this very stereotyped notion of Salvadoran people, on migrants, on, you know, what she believes is the culture of hardworking Central Americans in the United States. Like, it's terrible, man. It draws upon the most ridiculous, damaging, hurtful, racist stereotypes of Central American people possible, you know, and builds on, you know, Trumpian rhetoric of, like, for example, you know, when he says that MS-13 are animals and they're these violent criminals and they're bad hombres and they're rapists, right? It really just builds on that, right? Almost as if that's the new, you know, political kind of common sense about what Central America is to this administration. And so she just builds on that. She can't recognize, right, the humanity of this working class person, right? She can't recognize the fact that this is a person who, through, as we've now found out, right, administrative error, was deported to El Salvador, when this person had done absolutely nothing wrong and had temporary protected status and all of this, no?
Just to be clear with the timeline, she admitted that this was an administrative error, but then still went on that rant that we just heard. So please continue.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's no way that, first of all, much like Trump, there's no sense that the administration can admit anything, has done anything wrong, right? Everyone's against him. Everyone wants to stop what it is that they're doing, right? She says, we can't focus on these individual cases. We got to think about MS-13, you know, the now terrorist organization, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that, you know, she's really hired to do, right? Sort of spin all these kinds of issues in that direction and support the Trump agenda by any means necessary. And it's so clear here, you can't unlink that from this really racist and xenophobic perspective on what migrant people are in general, right? They're just inherently criminal. You know, the clip of the wife speaking about her husband, right? And
yeah,
and their family, like, just goes to show you that these are humble people, you know, making ends meet, working class people, right? Who have absolutely no connection to these criminal structures that they're going on about. The fact that the U.S. government, right, with all of its resources and intelligence about transnational criminal organizations, et cetera, is able to make this kind of quote unquote administrative error is absolutely baffling to me, right? Because it's absurd, right? This is a person, right, who has no criminal record. Is a Salvador national, but has lived in Maryland for quite a long time, right? Has a couple of children who I believe are special needs as well, right? There's no indication that this person was involved in any kind of illegal or criminal activity. In fact, right, fled El Salvador precisely because he was attempted to be forcefully recruited into gangs, you know? And so, like, it's just absurd, right? That, like, that sort of criminalizing logic that the Trump administration is operating under is almost the same one that the Bukele administration is operating under too, where depending on where you're from, right, and what your background is, what your class is, who your family is, right, you're guilty by association. And I think that's the kind of logic that the administration is operating under, and that the Bukele administration is operating under precisely why, and this is precisely why, right, they've been able to arbitrarily detain thousands upon thousands of people in San Salvador, in the, you know, in the Secot, in the maximum security prison, and in others, precisely for being from the wrong community, right, or for being related to somebody who might actually be involved, but you have absolutely no control over that person, you're not that person, right? But it's this kind of guilt by association that they're operating under, and they keep mobilizing in the discourse, right, that everybody from El Salvador that we've deported is obviously MS-13, right, or is obviously 18th Street, or is obviously, for the Venezuelans, right, Tren de Aragua. It's this one-size-fits-all criminalizing logic that is absolutely false and ridiculous and dehumanizes, you know, Salvadorians and Central American working-class people, right, and Latin American working-class people in general, right, as being associated with the criminal elements that are found in their nations or in their communities, you know? And that's an absurd sort of conflation that they're operating under. They don't want to, you know, recognize the fact, right, that people like Kilmar, right, are law-abiding, that are, you know, contribute to their communities, that are, you know, have a strong network of support and, you know, strong relationships with their families, right, that they're building their own families in places like Maryland. Like, they simply do not want to recognize that, because to recognize that, I think, from the perspective of the Trump administration, is a sort of kind of slippery slope, right? Where then they're going to have to recognize the legitimate claims of belonging and of permanence of Central American people in the United States.
You're listening to the best of the Latino Media Collective in 2025 here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. So in addition to the demonization of Salvadorans, the Trump administration has also demonized Venezuelans as gang members under the guise of the Tren de Aragua narrative. Venezuelan sociologist Maria Paez Victor spoke with us in May and minced no words on the fascists who pushed the narrative. There is a whole tsunami of misinformation with regards to Venezuela, Venezuelan migrants, and of course the Tren de Aragua narrative that has really fomented fear and paranoia here in the U.S. But I want to begin with your recent Counterpunch article, because you made a bold statement on the Tren de Aragua narrative in the U.S. with the following, quote, in September of 2023, combined forces of the Venezuelan police and military arrested, disbanded, and eliminated the local thugs called Tren de Aragua. At the same time, the authorities cleaned out Tocoron prison in the state of Aragua and retook control from the gangs. The leaders were captured, and those few that escaped had Interpol warrants issued against them. End quote. Long story short, this gang that has become the source of fear and paranoia in the U.S., whether it be the government or in corporate media, seems to be almost non-existent, according to your article. Can you expand on this argument against the corporate media narrative? Because this is quite a bold statement to make, and it's one of the things that compelled me to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. You know, I followed this, and I think the whole country followed it, because it was so amazing. There was this prison, a pretty large prison, called Tocoron in Aragua, and all kinds of criminal things were happening around there. It turns out that it was being run by the prisoners. The prisoners had taken over this prison, and it was their headquarters for all kinds of horrible things like blackmail and killing people and drugs. And they had turned, and this is, in a sense, it sounds funny, but it really isn't. They turned the prison into like a hotel. It was like a hotel instead of a prison. They had a pool. They had a nursery school for their kids. They had hairdressers. They had everything that you can imagine in a gigantic sort of spa. And of course, they were armed to the teeth. because the arms entered and went the same thing as the drugs. Well, they kept this kind of quiet. And then when the authorities realized, my goodness, a prison is being run by the prisoners because of all of the malfeasance that they were doing in the area. Well, 11,000 security personnel went in there. This was a mix of military and police. And they went in there to clean this out. Now, I must say, and please permit me to say this, as a Venezuelan, I felt so proud of those armed people, because I would have expected that there was going to be a gunfight, that they were going to, you know, kill each other, you know, and there wasn't a gunfight. This was amazing. First of all, because there were some people in there, who, like women, and there were also children in there. And what the police did was this sort of new type of policing where you talk to them and you talk to them and you calm them down and told them, look, we're 11,000. You're completely surrounded. Please give yourself up. And it was through that kind of sort of pacific policing that they got all of these guys. They got them. And they did not kill them. They did not put them against the wall and shoot them and whatever. But a few did escape. And those that escaped, immediately the government called Interpol and said who they were and that they had escaped. So this was a very impressive operation where there was no wild gun battle or killings. And what happened was that, and again, I'm telling you, I feel very proud of the authorities, but I feel very ashamed of the leaders of the opposition of Venezuela, because, and I'm going to tell you, they are fascists. I'm not saying this as an adjective. I am not insulting them. I'm not saying this as an exaggeration, but Maria Corina Machado, Leopoldo López, Borges, this pandilla, Guaido, although Guaido is so stupid, I don't think he even understands what fascism is, but these people are so right-wing and fascist that they came up with this idea. They came up with the idea to sell this to the United States. And so what they did, they called Ted Cruz and they called this Marco Rubio. I'm sorry that you have someone of that type there. And they said, this is an international terrorist group. These guys were thugs. You know, these were local matones, as we say, okay? And so they said, they are an international terrorist group. And furthermore, the government of Maduro has introduced these people into the United States with the migrants. Now, this is a double betrayal. Not only did these leaders of the opposition, by the way, leaders of the opposition outside the country, because they can't go back anyway.
Before you continue, I just want to add that in your Counterpunch article, you specifically mentioned a 2024 meeting between Texas Senator Ted Cruz and several of these right-wing Venezuelan opposition leaders that you mentioned. So, of course, I want you to continue. Could you tell us how a meeting like the one that you mentioned with people like Ted Cruz set the false Tren de Aragua narrative in motion? You also mentioned Marco Rubio as well, but there's a third character here that I would like to mention, and that's Maria Elvira Salazar from Florida, who is also as nefarious as Cruz, as Rubio.
Yes.
And as recently as January or February of last year, was pushing for more anti-Venezuelan legislation, but please continue.
And so was Corina Machado. Now, this is, as I said, a double betrayal. Not only have these people betrayed Venezuela, they betrayed these migrants. Remember, La Machado and this Salazar and all of these people were the ones who told these people to come to the United States, who got the Biden administration to open the doors to them so that they could easily. It's not easy to migrate to the United States. You have to go through all kinds of red tape. These people were told, oh, come, you know, we want you here. And then when they're here, this woman and the Salazar and Rubio and all of those started saying, with these migrants, the Maduro government has introduced criminals to the United States. The Maduro government, who just cleaned them all off, and the ones that escaped called Interpol about it. And so this was a double betrayal by these people. Well, this was backed by something called Insight Crime, which is an NGO in the United States, which is financed by the State Department. This was backed by the Washington Post, by Marco Rubio, by CNN, by Fox, by The Economist. They all contributed to the myth of this non-existent organized terrorist crime organization. And so the outrageous lie became newsworthy. And that's why President Trump went on, you know, TV and said, Venezuela is sending its criminals to the United States. He didn't invent this. These people told the president this lie, you know. So what has happened that, and I feel very sorry for them. I pray for them every night because what happened to them is exactly what happened to the Jews in the pogroms of Tsarist Russia in the 1800s. The same thing that the Nazis did to the Jews in Germany. They went out and grabbed them, these people without uniforms, with masks on their face, grabbed these people from their homes, from schools, from their place of work. They could not say anything in their defense. There was no trial. There was no lawyers. And let me tell you, when I say this in my article, the butchers of Nazi Germany after the war had the right to a trial in Nuremberg and to have lawyers defend them. But Venezuelans in the United States did not merit habeas corpus, did not merit a lawyer, did not merit having a trial. So they were grabbed without evidence. Some of them had tattoos. You know how youth are now. Now the youth always puts tattoos of all sorts. Well, if they had any tattoo, the tattoo. I don't know where they got this. This is ridiculous.
Yes.
And so these people were beaten, their heads shaved. They were sold to El Salvador, to the dictator Bukele is down there, who got $6 million and placed in a concentration camp in El Salvador. And this is a terrible thing that El Salvador has done.
We end part one of the Latino Media Collective Best of 2025 by going full circle to look back on the Trump administration's decision to send the National Guard here in Washington, D.C. And to do so, we sought out the wisdom of both James Early and Puerto Rican independence writer Alberto Medina to discuss why this incident in August lends itself to both the importance of statehood in Washington and full independence in Puerto Rico.
This is an escalation of the racialized MAGA and Trump attack, which is about a white supremacy reclaiming of an official narrative of who is an American, and therein, who are the second and third class considerations. So Washington, D.C. has become the beachhead, but we must recognize that the precedent for this was against Latinos on the border. This is where we first saw this really concentrated, racialized, extrajudicial use of official violence, which is generally used in foreign countries and or for natural disasters, to really attack Latinos in particular, or in the Southwest on the border. Coming into the nation's capital, the political capital of the United States, escalates that further, now with three jurisdictions, state jurisdictions, adding their National Guard to come in to Washington. And the particularity of Washington as distinct from the states in the Southwest is that Washington does not have full bourgeois democracy in the United States. It is a district. It is not a full state. And were we able to express the same kind of democratic aspirations as South Carolina or as Iowa or New York City? And so that to take over Washington, D.C., a city that is still about 48% Black, not the chocolate city that I arrived in 1971, when it, I think, was almost like 70% Black. It's more now like chocolate chip city. But this is a major escalation in the militarization of the United States. And again, against a Black population, particularly against Black youth, who are in the most historically underdeveloped areas of Washington, that reads the lack of education, the lack of employment, high incarceration, in some instances where uncles and fathers have only been seen by their children and their nephews in jails. And so that this is a systemic underdevelopment. And of course, yes, crime needs to be controlled, and you've always got people who are out of control. But to characterize a whole community when this is a systemic problem, I would just stop on this. We have also a political problem in Washington that initially the mayor of Washington and the police chief of Washington claimed that they welcomed this because they needed extra people power to deal with already a descending factor of crime. But at the same time, they could give a $1 billion giveaway to bring a football team in here. They have no problems allocating that money. So that the claim that this was simply a matter of needing extra policing people power is problematic. We must, I think, though, support the pushback on them that forced them to take up a legal case against the imposition of taking over the police department. And they're able to hold the Trump administration in stasis at this moment. The last point, though, is that we have a problem that's two-dimensional in this fiction that we have congressional representation. The representation from Washington is a delegate. If you go look at the history of the UN and places like that, these are less than full representative powers because the Congress can take over any action or overturn any action of DC. We don't have a congressional representative. We have a delegate. But we have a delegate who has a stellar civil rights record, but who at 88 years of age and in failing health refuses to give up that position. And the people around her, just as the people around Joe Biden, are hiding that back and not taking on their responsibility. So that's the context.
Even now, as we have this conversation, there are talks of bringing more National Guard troops to Washington, and they're coming here for a variety of reasons. But the main one, in my opinion, are those that you just mentioned here in this conversation. So with that said, though, flying under the radar with what has taken place this month in Washington and last month in Los Angeles is the Trump administration dismissing 5 of the 7 members of the Puerto Rico Financial Oversight and Management Board, the entity that, for all intents and purposes, governs Puerto Rico, according to Alberto's recent article in Jacobin. So although Puerto Ricans are not fans at all of the FOMB, Alberto, could you tell us how this recent development is a step in the wrong direction in the island? Here in Washington, we have a financial board, probably doesn't affect Washington to the same devastating effect in Puerto Rico, but I feel like the audience needs to know the importance of this decision here.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just maybe start providing a little bit of context on what the board is and why it came to be. You know, Puerto Rico, about 10 years ago, got to a critical point in a building debt crisis in which it declared that about $70 billion in public debt was not payable. However, Puerto Rico, because of a decision by Congress, because Congress decided to exclude Puerto Rico from the bankruptcy code, essentially, Puerto Rico could not declare Chapter 9 bankruptcy, as U.S. municipalities can do. And of course, Puerto Rico is not a sovereign nation, so it could not avail itself of the mechanisms of sovereign nations to restructure its debt. So Congress had to do something. And what it did was pass this law called PROMESA, signed by President Obama in 2016, to give Puerto Rico a debt restructuring process. And it created this Financial Oversight and Management Board, with which Puerto Ricans, I always say not very lovingly, call La Junta, to oversee this debt restructuring process. And what the board is, it is 7 unelected bureaucrats appointed by the President of the United States who have almost unlimited power over Puerto Rico, because Congress, in order to have the board oversee the island's debt restructuring, basically gave the board the power of the purse. It gave the board the power to even overrule Puerto Rico's elected government, to annul Puerto Rican laws, essentially, if it believes that those laws would have a quote-unquote adverse impact on Puerto Rico's finances, right? And who determines what's good or bad for Puerto Rico's finances? The board does. And what the board has determined for the last 10 years or so, because again, this began in 2016, is that what Puerto Rico needs is a massive austerity program. So the board has slashed pensions. It has cut funding for public education, for all kinds of public services, all in the name of making sure that bondholders, you know, many of them hedge funds, vulture funds, get paid. But of course, even though they have been profiting massively already, many of these bondholders want to get paid even more. that's how we get to where we are now. You know, there was a sort of far-right campaign led by figures like Laura Loomer, who folks may know has been getting all kinds of people in the Trump administration fired, to basically say these board members are terrible, they've done a bad job. They've used as an excuse something which is actually true, that, you know, the board has spent money left and right, you know, hundreds of millions on consultants and lawyers, all of which is paid for by the Puerto Rican people, by the way, because even though the board was established by Congress, Puerto Rico foots the bill, even as the board is sort of dismantling, you know, Puerto Rican society, which is a real insult to injury, I would say. But this is what the Trump administration has used as an excuse to get rid, not of the board itself, which would be great if the board was eliminated, but to get rid initially of the five Democrats on the board. Since I wrote my article, Trump has actually removed an additional member who is a Republican, but was appointed by President Obama initially. So he's gotten rid of six of the seven members of the board. And by all indication, he will replace them with folks who are even more friendly to bondholders, who are going to push for more austerity. One of the big fights right now is specifically about the debt that was issued by PREPA, which is Puerto Rico's former, you know, public power utility, until the board forced Puerto Rico to privatize its electric grid. And, you know, there's a lot of hedge funds and bondholders who have been pushing for the power utility, these power companies in Puerto Rico, to raise the rates to make electricity, which the service is terrible in Puerto Rico, and it's also one of the most expensive, you know, in the United States, if not the world. Let's hike the prices up on poor Puerto Ricans even more, so that there's more money in the coffers, so that bondholders can get paid even more. So again, you know, Trump has not appointed the replacements yet for the board members that he fired. But I think if you have a little bit of a sense of what his politics, his concern or lack thereof for Puerto Ricans, and how he approaches these issues, it's a pretty fair bet that what's coming when he does appoint new members is going to be terrible for Puerto Ricans. It's going to be more austerity.
It's a good thing that you mentioned Obama, because we have to let people know that the nefarious nature of the control board, the financial control board, is not exclusive to Donald Trump, the individual, and it's not even exclusive to the Republican Party. It's a bipartisan view of Puerto Rico that's rooted in its colonial history. And so with that said, I want to turn my attention back to James here. And before we actually had this conversation, in our email correspondence, James, you mentioned to me that your work with participation in the Puerto Rico Solidarity Committee as DC chair for a number of years during your Howard University PhD program graduate student days was pivotal in your ideological and political development on global justice identity. Could you tell us more about this experience and how we could draw parallels with DC statehood and Puerto Rican independence, respectively? I think this is the main thing that we need to do to tie both of these issues in this conversation.
So I came to Washington in 1971, and in the 70s, Puerto Rico was a really hot topic in the progressive and in the left movement. The National Lawyers Guild and a number of people, the Center for Constitutional Rights, all rallied around the independence movement, particularly through the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, founded and led at that time by Juan Mari Bras. I can remember meeting with him and Anglada, his right-hand assistant, in the congressional office of Congressman Juan Dellums to talk about the independence of Puerto Rico. The late Arthur Canoy and I, Arthur Canoy was a prominent progressive lawyer who was one of the founders of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And I testified on the U.S. Committee on two different occasions, the Oversight Committee of the Colony of Puerto Rico, the Commonwealth, as it was referred to in those days. And so being around those older progressive activists and around the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, which had a very well-developed division in New York City with people like Digna Sanchez, who is now back in Puerto Rico with the Hostiano Committee. As a young 25, 26-year-old, this was my first deep exposure to sort of an all-sided ideological, political, organizing, mobilizing party. And it was also my first experience with learning the significance of lobbying policymakers and the importance of that front as a part of a larger front of activity. So my first trip to Cuba was the first international conference on the independence of Puerto Rico. And so Puerto Rico and Cuba, un pájaro con dos alas, one bird with two wings. Every year at the UN, the Cubans organize a declaration for the independence of Puerto Rico because their history goes back to the anti-colonial fight against Spain, in which the United States interrupted that and colonized Puerto Rico at the same time that they colonized Cuba and the Philippines all the way into Hawaii. So it's a very rich interconnected history, which I intersected. And so it had a lot of impact, influence on my own intellectual development, as well as my political social justice activities.
You're listening to part one of the Latino Media Collective 2025 Year in Review here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. Wishing everyone a safe holiday as we prepare to continue the struggle in 2026. Stay safe, everyone.
Thank you doesn't seem to be adequate. Your support is critical. Thank you, thank you, thank you again. We appreciate you partnering with WPFW and helping to make our end-of-year drive a success. If you would still like to support WPFW, make us stronger, it is never too late. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org. Thank you for considering WPFW in this season of giving. Wishing you and yours joy, love, and peace.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, December 26th. Here are some headlines. The United States has launched airstrikes against Islamic State-affiliated groups in northwestern Nigeria. According to President Trump, these strikes had a religious justification and started off another step in his so-called anti-terror campaign, with no definitive end date. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Yesterday, on Christmas Day, the Trump administration launched airstrikes in northern Nigeria, signaling the start of operations in the region. A Trump administration official said that Christmas was chosen as the symbolic start date in an operation that does not appear to have a finite end date or goal. What is known, however, is that the Nigerian government knew of these strikes beforehand and welcomed the attack on ISIS-linked militias. Nigerian citizens on the ground reacted with surprise and panic to the airstrikes, and at least one has since complained that the Nigerian government did not properly safeguard its citizens. President Trump claimed that the attack was necessary to protect Christians, even though sectarian violence strikes at both Christians and Muslims in the country. Nigeria's government went out of its way to emphasize how extremism affects both sides. The total damage from the airstrikes are unknown, although several fatalities are expected. The attacks in Nigeria, like those in the Caribbean, were carried out without consulting Congress, leading some congressmen to once again criticize Trump's violent and secretive foreign policy. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Another step in his... In other news, Christmas Eve did not play out as planned at the Kennedy Center this year. The center's annual Christmas Eve jazz performance was called off after drummer and vibraphone player Chuck Redd, who has hosted the show for nearly two decades, said that he canceled the show after learning the cultural arts institution was adding Donald Trump to its name. As of last Friday, the building's facade reads the Donald J. Trump and the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts, a decision made by Trump's hand-picked board, which he himself now chairs. Chuck Redd is not the only artist to protest recent changes at the Kennedy Center. Lin-Manuel Miranda canceled a planned production of Hamilton after learning Trump took over the board and named himself chairman. In related news, a new federal lawsuit filed on Monday in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia challenges the Kennedy Center Board of Trustees' decision to rename the Kennedy Center. The suit was filed by Ohio Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, an ex officio trustee of the center. The suit alleges the board exceeded its authority granted by Congress and requests that a judge declare it to be void. The lawsuit comes as President Trump pursues a campaign to rename institutions in the nation's capital in his own image. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.